Hello, this is Reverend Judith Laxer. Thank you for listening to the podcast of our service entitled The Goddess of Love. My wish is that the food for thought offered brings great nourishment for your soul. Our ministry for the goddess is supported solely by those who, like you, partake of its teachings. We're currently running our annual pledge drive. If you feel served by listening, please go to our website, www.gaiastemple.org, to make your pledge and push the donate button now and give generously. We'd be most grateful. Thank you and blessed be. Well, my friends, the core values of Gaia's Temple are peace, respect, integrity, and love. And what better day than Valentine's Day than to talk about love? Talk about the value of love and how valuable it is. So here's an understatement. Holidays can be tough. And Valentine's Day is no exception, especially if you're single, because then you believe that Valentine's Day is for everybody else. But Valentine's Day is more than just for romantic couples, because love is for everyone, including romantic love, even if you are single, because you can be in love. You can live in love. You can be in love with romance. You can create romance. Romance doesn't have to just be with another person. You can romance your entire life if you choose to. We have a very limited view of love, mostly, and all of its ramifications, which I'm going to talk more about, but including and especially the erotic. We have the erotic in a very small, tight little camp for one specific reason and purpose. And today I want to help us expand that understanding. So when the February service fell on, you know, Valentine's Day, I thought, well, got to talk about the goddess of love. And who is that? Aphrodite. Mighty Aphrodite. She was called Aphrodite to the Greeks. She's called Venus to the Romans. We know the planet Venus as the goddess of love. And so last February, I spoke about her also. But can we ever talk about love enough? Can we ever learn about love enough? Can we ever practice love enough? I think not. So first I want to talk a little bit about her origin story. And it goes like this. So Gaia, the great mother, and Uranus, the great father, like according to the Greeks, the original mother and father, right? The primordial parents, earth and sky, gave birth to the Titans, which were the first echelon of gods. And however, as the Titans began to grow up, Uranus wanted to make sure that he would stay in power. Because we know what happens, right? We get older, we start to lose our power, or the next generation coming up is going to come into their power. But Uranus did not want to lose his power. And so he either hid or tried to kill his children to avoid that fate. And of course, this did not make Gaia very happy at all. And so she incited her children to rise up and attack their father so that this wouldn't happen to them, right? Here we go. We're already at war. Even in the very early days, war seems to be the way we go about it. Anyway, she gave one of her sons named Cronus a sickle as a tool to fight this war against his father. And so what does he do? He goes and he uses the sickle and he severs his father's genitals with them and he throws them into the ocean. That's how we begin this story. So I just want to talk a little bit about Cronus here and this particular act, because you can't just say, oh, he severed his father's genitals, throw them in the ocean, and skip over it like nothing just happened. That's a very big deal. So the first thing is that Cronus, as we know, the word Cronus speaks to time. It's the root of the word chronology, chronological, the crone in synchronicity. It's referring to a particular period of time or the passing of time, or that time does pass. So we can look at this kind of symbolically and we can say that time is going to steal our life force. It's going to steal our power, and ultimately it's going to steal our life. So we can look at that act very symbolically that way. But another way that I want to point out to look at this in this myth is that Cronus is a child. And so he's coming from a child's viewpoint, which is not yet mature, or we can say is rather immature. And so he thinks that the only way that he can wrest power from his father is to sever his genitals, right? To take away his prowess. And then that means that he will be able to have power. So right away, I just want to say, acts of violence and trying to steal power from others is not necessary for us to become empowered. We can become empowered of our own auspices without feeling we need to wrest it away from anyone else, particularly violently. So that's just the first little point I want to make right off the bat there. So anyway, the genitals go into the ocean and foam forms all around them, which we might look at in a million and one different ways. And eventually up out of that foam arises Aphrodite. And her name, literally the etymology of her name, means risen from sea foam. That's exactly what her name means. Up comes Aphrodite, beautiful, gorgeous, lovable, desirable, and riding a clamshell, she arrives on the shores of Greece. So this whole thing about, we can look at the clamshell as sort of metaphoric way also, because, you know, we know the Greeks, you know, these myths are ancient Greeks, and yet the goddess of love was seen as Astarte in Phoenicia, which is modern day Lebanon, and she was seen as Inanna in Sumeria, which is modern day Iraq. So we can look at the goddess of love, her origins were probably in the Middle East. And so then she arrives on the shore of Greece, like across the Mediterranean going into Southern Europe. And so we can look at that clamshell and her arrival there out of the waters as a way that the goddess of love emigrated from country to country. So that's another way to look at how the goddess of love sort of gets around, you know? So Aphrodite arrives on the shore. She is a goddess. And the first gift that she brings with her is beauty, because she is beautiful. So I just want to talk about the gifts of the goddess. I'm going to talk about the gifts of the goddess today a lot. But the one thing I want to say to sort of preface that is, you know, like last month I was talking about, we talked about the goddess Bridget, and we talked about her at our Imbolc ritual also, and the gifts that she brings of smithcraft and healing and poetry and the waters from her well and the fires that we use to forge our lives. So as we learn about these gods and goddesses, we want to know what are the gifts that they bring to us, and how do we use them for our own spiritual growth and to enhance our own personal lives? So Aphrodite comes on the scene and she brings beauty, which we can sometimes say is something frivolous or something that we shouldn't strive for or that it's very shallow. Now, when we say that that's all that matters is beauty, or if we look at beauty through a very limited lens, we can say that's kind of shallow. But beauty itself as a gift is not shallow or frivolous. It is crucial and it is important. So she is beautiful. So she arrives on the scene like she takes everyone's breath away. Everyone falls madly in love with her. They lose her minds over Aphrodite and they want to possess her because she's so beautiful that they want her. So again, I just want to say this about possession of things that are beautiful. Beauty inspires desire in us. I want to talk more about that too. We see something beautiful, we want it. Ooh, another crystal, it's beautiful, I must have it, right? Or we look at someone or something and we see that it's beautiful and we want to have it. There's nothing wrong with that longing or that desire as long as we have permission to take it. So in so many of the stories about Aphrodite, like people just drop their morals and ethics in their desire to have her. And we can look at what happens in the world too about we'll see someone who's beautiful or we'll see someone or something that's desirable. And somehow we just drop all of our understandings about what's civil and we just want to take it, whether it wants to be taken or not. And so there's a responsibility that we have to our desire and how we let desire carry us forward in the world. So everybody falls in love with Aphrodite. Everybody wants Aphrodite. She inspires love because we love what is beautiful. It's in our nature to just love what is beautiful. The thing to keep in mind, of course, is that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, And what that means is everybody finds different things beautiful. Something that I would find beautiful, or to my taste, you might not find beautiful. But one way or another, we know that her presence reminds us that beauty is in the world. And that's a good thing to be reminded of, especially in times, the times that we're living in, when so much of what we see in the world is not beautiful. We find now that we're seeing mostly the worst of humanity being played out in all the arenas in which we know. But she brings beauty onto the scene, and we are reminded that beauty is soothing and it's inspiring and that it is pleasant. So she inspires love because we love what's beautiful. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And if we stick to what I believe are very narrow cultural views of what beauty is, we're going to miss out on a lot of things that are truly beautiful. Like for example, please observe Exhibit A. This is called the Goddess of Willendorf, or the Venus of Willendorf. At some point, this was what we considered the pinnacle of beauty. Huge, pendulous breasts, big belly, like all the things that we are trying desperately now to have in our era, right? So we have a very narrow view of what beauty should be. Now our magazines and Hollywood and, you know, whatever it is in out there in the world tells us that to be beautiful, we must be, you know, skinny and 9 times out of 10 blonde. And, you know, there's like this certain idea of what beauty is, and it's very, very narrow. And we must remember to expand and understand that beauty is not only in the eye of the beholder, but it really does come from within. It's who you are. It's how you behave. It's not necessarily if you have a pleasing appearance. And I have seen, and I know people, and including looking in the mirror, at things that I don't really often think are all that beautiful according to cultural norms, but what happens in my relationship with them and how they are in the world is beautiful. So we have to really expand our understanding of what beauty is, that it's not only appearance. I mean, this is just basic stuff, I know, but I think it's important to really bring up because we forget. And this is why the commercialization of a holiday like today is so dangerous to our hearts and mind, because it perpetuates shallow aesthetics. You know, like only if we're pretty enough or handsome enough or beautiful enough or privileged enough or wealthy enough or whatever that is, will we have a partner and be happy. And it's not only narrow, but it's not true. Right? There can be absolute beautiful, magnificent people according to the cultural norm, and they might not be happy and they might not be in relationships. So it's very dangerous to keep those blinders on and see that's a very narrow viewpoint. Aphrodite reminds us of the joy of love, how joyful it is to experience love. Loving is joyous, and it can be, and it should be joyous. In our current world, with alternative facts and conspiracy theories and up is down and left is right, Aphrodite reminds us that love is real. Thank you so much, Celia. That was so beautiful and so true. Thank you. Thank you so much. So another sort of byproduct of the gift of Aphrodite's beauty is the gift of desire, because we desire what is beautiful. We love what's beautiful, and then we desire it. We want to have it. Desire is a motivating force, right? If we desire something, we are motivated to do something about it in order to get it or obtain it. There are other emotions that are motivating forces too, like anger. If we're angry about something, anger will like push us to take action, certainly. But isn't desire a much more pleasant way to go about going after what it is that we want? So it's a motivating force. This is an alive force that motivates us. Desire inspires pleasure, and pleasure is pleasurable. So, you know, pleasure is our birthright. And this is a pagan worship service. Yay, pagans, and the whole principle of pleasure. Because pleasure can be for its own sake. Pleasure can be its own purpose. There can be no other reason, or there need not be any other reason to desire pleasure than pleasure itself. It's okay to desire pleasure. Now, this is counter to a lot of what we have been conditioned and a lot of what we have been taught, not only from our religious faiths that we might have been raised in, but also in the culture at large, which you would think that really wouldn't be the case, but it really kind of is. So, you know, if we were raised in a lot of the mainstream religions, particularly some of the stricter, more fundamental ones, then, you know, that pleasure was a sin, actually. And things that were pleasurable, like I said before, were frivolous. They were not important, that would make us bad, that would say we were immoral, we would become hedonistic. I mean, just horrible, horrible things to desire and want to have a pleasurable life. We would inherently be bad and wrong if we were seeking that out. And that, I believe, is one of the ways that those religions sought to have power over those who followed their ways, because wanting pleasure, having pleasure, and experience pleasure in our bodies is a natural thing. And so if you try to say that what is natural is unnatural and suppress it, then you're going to have people that are suffering, and then you're going to frighten them into remaining in that situation and being so that you can remain in power. So it's a construct, and it's so misguided, I believe. I believe it is just so misguided. It's okay to desire pleasure simply because pleasure is pleasurable. Nothing wrong with that. Then out in our culture out there, you know, we have all of these ideas that pleasure should only be a reward if we work hard enough, if we're deserving enough, if we've earned enough money, if we've followed the rules, if we listen to what other people tell us, if we're within a very tight sort of confine or construct, only then is it okay to have pleasure, and not for too long, just a little bit, and don't overindulge. I mean, there are so many reasons and constructs in our world that are telling us that we should not seek pleasure, or that if we do, there's something wrong with us. And then, on top of everything else, it's, you know, when we're living in the difficult times that we are right now, we can think that seeking pleasure means that we're not really paying attention to what matters out there, as opposed to why wouldn't we want to counter what is going on out there and bring some balance back in with beauty and pleasure and desire. Like, that is a worthy thing to go for, rather than tossing it by the wayside because everything's so horrible anyway. Why should we bother? You know, so there's so many things that go on in our psyche that are telling us that we shouldn't be going for this beauty and desire and love and pleasure. And I'm here to say that I think that is completely misguided. And I think we should turn around and try very hard to create beauty and love and desire and pleasure everywhere and in every way that we possibly can. And so one way to do this, of course, is to look to erotic energy. And I want to talk about erotic energy. And I want to start with Eros, who is the god of love, who is actually one of Aphrodite's children, was Eros, known as Cupid in Rome, and Aphrodite's son with Ares, the god of war. And Ares was the great warrior. And I think, you know, Cupid's bow and arrow was like one of Ares' weapons. So we can kind of look at that a little symbolically also. But one way or another, if you were struck by Cupid's arrow, that's it. You were like in love. You were under the spell. You had no power, you know, other than to feel that. But I would really like to expand what we understand eroticism to be and erotic energy to be. Because, oh, there's one thing that I did want to say here also. When I looked up like Eros and what it said about him, it said that he is who loosens the limbs and weakens the mind. That's kind of the combination of what Eros brings to us. So it weakens the mind, and, you know, again, that's sort of like, oh, I'm powerless to the feelings that I feel. No, we can have strong, intense feelings and not be powerless to them. That's the level of consciousness that we need to have. I've got a strong feeling here. What am I going to do with it in the right, correct way? Anyway, so I don't know if you know of a woman named Esther Perel, but if you don't, I think you should go and look her up. She is a therapist, a couples therapist, an author, and an amazing speaker on relationships. She's got a fabulous TED Talk, and there's a lot of videos and YouTubes where she is speaking about all of that, relations, being in relationship, healthy relationships, and eroticism specifically. And what she says is that we here in the West particularly have a very limited view on Eros, particularly because we see it only as something that is aligned with our sexuality. So last year when I was talking about Aphrodite in Gaia's Temple at the February service, I said, you know, we're gifted with the ability to reach ecstatic states within our body. That is a gift that we have by being human. And I don't think that that is random. You know, I think it was a good idea that we were created this way, that, you know, sex would feel so good that we would continue to want to do it. And that's how we would continue to procreate. But we also know that we can have sex without procreating. So that can't be all that there is to it. There is something else about reaching those ecstatic states. And I believe that's where our spirituality and our bodies meet. That is a beautiful thing. I mean, that's the thing we're striving for in this life, right? To be having this spiritual experience in human form. Esther tells us so many beautiful things, and I want to lay them all out here for you because it's just magnificent. She says that Eros, erotic energy, is a life force energy. And what it does is it brings our lives meaning, purpose, creativity, playfulness, and connection. Meaning, purpose, creativity, playfulness, and connection. Who wouldn't want any of those things? All of us want all of those things. So if we think of eroticism as an energy, one of the energies that we have and we can use that isn't just limited to our sexuality, then we have access to something that can infuse our entire lives. Erotic energy brings us aliveness and vibrancy, and it does it by centralizing desire and pleasure and satisfaction. So again, we've been taught that centralizing these things, desire and pleasure and satisfaction, makes us selfish or frivolous or somehow immoral, or like there's something wrong with us if we want to centralize these things. But when we're truly utilizing erotic energy in our life, we centralize these things. Like, this is important enough to go for. And I believe that it is. The other thing she says about eroticism is that it's linked to possibility. And she talks about, you know, we're always striving to be more like the animals in the animal kingdom, because they are so present in the moment. They are right here in the moment. We're still not certain whether they can think ahead We know that they can become, you know, we teach a dog tricks, for instance, so we know that they have habits and they can remember what to do, but we don't necessarily know if they remember what happened to them when they were a puppy, you know, in a conscious way. But humans, we can look ahead. We can remember what took place in the past. So eroticism brings us into the future a little bit, or at least is linked to the possibility of living. Because if there is something that we find pleasurable, something that we desire, let's say for the sake of argument, it's going to be that chocolate that we're having for dessert tonight. Right now, we can be thinking about that chocolate and we're already having a pleasurable experience. It might not be as pleasurable as when we're actually eating and tasting the chocolate, but it creates a kind of anticipation of a possibility in the future. And now Eros is carrying us along. So it's not limited to the experience in the moment. Esther tells us that erotic energy has no other function other than a state of well-being, a state of transcendence, and a state of presence. Erotic energy is in our lives for us to be well, for us to be able to transcend situations and to feel that spiritual connection that helps us transcend the mundane. Erotic energy makes us incredibly present right here, right now. What a beautiful thing that is to access and to have in our lives. She also said that sex is not just something that we do. Sex is somewhere we go. Talk about an expansion of an understanding of something that we can experience. She says that sex is a lens through which other things can occur rather than an act that is finite. I would just love for everyone who is hearing those words to meditate on that, to contemplate on that, and continue to do so, to see if that can be something that is expanded in your life for your well-being, for your transcendence, and for your presence. So arousal is not limited to sex. And if we think that it is, if the only, when we hear the word arouse, we're only thinking about sex and sexuality, then that is so limited, because it's not the only place that we get aroused or the only way that we can get aroused. Our curiosity is aroused, our imaginations are aroused, right? So it's the arrival of something. It's when we conjure something up. That's really what arousal is. Sex is one place, but it's not the only place. And if it is the only place in your awareness and in your mind, again, I think it would be great to expand that so that you can experience this joy and beauty throughout your life, not just in your sexuality. But also to consider, and this is very true for us about all of our experiences, probably the first time we experience something, the imprint it makes on us goes very, very deep. And then we operate our lives from that imprint as if that is true from here on out. Which means that, we'll just take this right to sexuality. If your first sexual experience was not pleasurable, or even if it was, you have formed an idea of what that is for you. And then you continue to live your life as if that is your truth. And without examining it, expanding it, being willing to grow, applying your curiosity, allowing yourself to be vulnerable, to stretch where your edges are a little bit, it stays very, very limited. We could say that's immature, but immature kind of has a word of, like, it's kind of judgment. Oh, that's so immature. But we can say, it's rather undeveloped. Like, this isn't something that I have developed to go beyond whatever that initial informing was in my first experience. And, you know, just to take it to a completely different sense, you know, when I was a kid, spinach that we ate came out of a can. It was a slimy glop. And I was like, oh, I did not like it. I was in my 30s before I tried spinach again in a restaurant. And I was like, oh, my God, what have I been missing all these years? Fresh spinach. It's delicious. You know, so it's that sort of thing. Like, we form an idea about something early on. And that's good information, but it's not the whole show. And here is a place and an example where we can expand what we understand arousal to be, desire to be, eroticism to be, beyond just what we know sexually. So, there's that. The other thing is that erotic energy, like I said, it arouses our curiosity and our spontaneity and our imagination and our creativity. Those are beautiful things to keep our lives enjoyable and exciting and growing and continually growing. I mean, if we're here, we might as well grow. If we're here, we might as well get what we came here for. Erotic energy is an experience, and what it does is it shifts our perceptions. It brings us into an altered state. We can say that we are going to, for example, you know, have to wash the dishes, and that's not much fun. Or we can say we're going to put our hands in the hot, warm, soapy water, and we're going to create beauty out of these dirty dishes into something clean and beautiful. I mean, that is just a completely altered state about something that can be seen, you know, can be seen as a mundane or unpleasant task. So that erotic energy can infuse everything in our life, how we have a conversation with someone, anything that we choose to do, anything that we want to experiment with. It's at our disposal, and we ought to use it. And the good news about that, my friends, is that you don't need a partner. You do not need a partner to create and infuse your life with this erotic energy, with eroticism. Erotic energy is alive, and we are enlivened by it. Things that are new, things that are exciting, these are the things that make us feel alive. And it doesn't matter how many years we've been living on this planet. There is always something new, no matter how old we are. Eroticism can still infuse our lives and make it pleasant while we are here. There's a philosophical viewpoint that eroticism actually is the antidote to death. Death is going to come, as we know. It's going to come. And when it comes, that is soon enough time for it to come and for it to happen. But until that moment, let's be alive. Let's be alive while we're here. And why not infuse our lives with pleasure? Why not? Why not? Can't think of one good reason. So I would recommend that you cultivate eros in your life. Keep your life vibrant and use it to manifest the life that you desire. So I'm going to ask us to take a look now at what it is that we might desire and where we can infuse that erotic energy. So if you would, take a moment now, close your eyes, and go within. Take a nice deep breath. And turn your focus and attention inward now. Inside yourself, your beautiful self. And bring your attention up to your third eye in the center of your forehead. Imagine it like an actual eye. And go ahead and open it up. And look out through it into your imagination and find yourself, like Aphrodite, standing on your clamshell, not far from the shore of your life. And you are safely standing there, riding very, very gentle waves, looking at your life that is depicted spread out all along the shoreline up ahead. And this viewpoint gives you a great advantage because you can see where things are going well in your life, where you have ease and joy, and confidence and delight and pleasure. The things you love and feel good about that bring you this pleasure and delight. So notice what those places are now from your vantage point on your half a clamshell there. Notice those places that are going so beautifully and are infused with that wonderful energy, and just take a moment to acknowledge them. Good, and take another deep breath. And now you notice that you can also see the place or places where you'd like to feel more ease and joy and confidence and delight in your life, but you're not there yet. You can spot exactly what needs this infusion of life force or eros to manifest beautifully. Now, there may be more than one place in your life where this is true, but for our purposes here today, choose just one of them. Choose one area of your life, one area, that isn't exactly where you want it to be yet, for whatever reason. It could be a place that doesn't feel pleasurable, or one that you still would like to feel more pleasure at, but someplace that is not there yet. You're not there yet. It's not pleasant. Find that place. And it could be that that place perhaps feels deadened by hardship or burden, or merely by repetition, right, which can bring about boredom. Find what that one place is now. Good. Now, considering what you have just been hearing about erotic energy as a life force, an energy that brings vibrancy and vitality and curiosity and playfulness and creativity. That's exactly the kind of energy you need to infuse this part of your life so that you can experience it with ease and joy, so that you can fall in love with it, find the beauty in it, feel the pleasure that it can bring. Even if this is a part of your life is a means to a future end, right? Like, why not find the way to enjoy that process? So ask yourself now how you can be curious about it. Open your mind to be curious about this part of your life rather than staying concretized in what you know about it. How can you be curious about it? And ask yourself how you can be more creative about it, something new that you can add to the mix. Introduce something new for creativity. How can you do that in this part of your life? Ask yourself how you can be more playful about it. Maybe take the stakes down a little bit. See what happens if it really doesn't matter if it happens well or not. What would happen if you just played? Ask yourself how you can apply the erotic energy that Aphrodite evokes, this vibrant life force, to shift your experience of this part of your life with more pleasure. See if you can shift your perception about this part of your life to infuse it with more pleasure, more purpose, more meaning, even if it's challenging. How can you infuse this challenge with love and beauty? And then go ahead and take another deep, deep breath and gently open your eyes and come back here with me in this temple. Now, just having these thoughts, asking yourself, how can I be more playful and creative and joyful? It doesn't mean we're going to come up with the answer right away, but it does sort of open up this possibility that our experience of something that maybe isn't everything we want it to be yet can get there, and it can get there by infusing it with eros, by infusing that erotic energy, so that we can have a different experience on the way to pleasure. Aphrodite's gifts of beauty are an aphrodisiac. So I encourage you, my friends, to cultivate beauty. Cultivate beauty everywhere you can, all environments, in any and every way you can, the best you can, in your home, in your office, in your yard, in your heart, in your body, in your mind, in the world? What is the most beautiful, hospitable, and welcoming environment you can create? That should be the pervading question, no matter what it is you do. How can I infuse this with beauty? Simple things that you can do right off the bat: clean up a little, tidy up a little bit, make something easier on the eye. Not chores, don't think of them as chores, but you might think of them as devotional acts to Aphrodite. I'm going to vacuum, and it's for Aphrodite. Totally different than, got to vacuum again. Those, you know, dust bunnies are getting the better of me. I like to light candles. I like to keep a stick of incense burning. It keeps me in a different altered state. It creates something beautiful for my senses in an ongoing way. If you take an extra moment to make whatever it is that you are doing more beautiful and to engage all of your senses, how can I make it look more beautiful if I tidy up or clean it up? How can I make things sound more beautiful? Do I need to turn up the music or turn off the ringer and the beep, 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 you know, sound, right? Or smell, how does it smell in here? Do I need to light a stick of incense? Do I need to empty the garbage? You know, do I need to get some flowers in here? Sense of smell. How do things feel? Am I cold? Am I too hot? Something that I'm wearing too tight? How does it feel to the touch on your physical body? Taste, is it something that tastes really good? Or if I add salt, will it taste better? Does it need more sugar? Does it need more hot sauce? You know, engage in all of your senses. Become more sensual to give yourself pleasure. When we do this, when we satisfy all of our senses, it's beautiful. And then wherever we are, it's a sanctuary that is blessed by the divine.
Let's bless the space. Please bless this space, this sanctuary.
Blessed be, allow it in, blessed be.
it is.
Thank you, Celia. So beautiful. Oh my goodness. Thank you so much, my friend. Celia has so many beautiful CDs and albums to purchase, so please do support her gorgeous music in the world. And I hope you go to that concert tonight also. So my friends, to recap, Aphrodite brings beauty, which inspires love, and love brings desire. We are responsible for our desires and need to tend them with our morals and ethics and true, pure eros at the forefront of our minds. Erotic energy is one of the best things that we are gifted with in our human bodies. And we need to start to think of it as an energy that we can use for more than just sexual expression. Apply that magic everywhere. Everywhere. Beauty and pleasure feel good. And with so much pain in the world, why not counter it with as much pleasure as we can conjure? Why not? So, my friends, may Aphrodite bless you all with all things pleasurable. May her love motivate you to create beauty everywhere, to infuse your life with the erotic, bringing vibrancy and joy. And may all of that bring peace. Happy Valentine's Day, Earth lovers, and blessed be.